Welcome to today's program titled New Year, New Progress 2016 Update on Defend Trade Secrets Act and EU Directive. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen and type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only. You are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Robert Milligan. You may begin.
Thank you, and thank you so much for joining today's webinar. We started today's program with a poll, the question being, does the United States need federal trade secret legislation? And for the preliminary results, I want to go ahead and share that with the audience. It looks like just under 70% of the audience agreed that we need to have federal trade secret legislation. As the presentation goes forward, your opinion may change as we get into some of the nuts and bolts of the federal trade secret legislation in the United States, as well as the proposed trade secret legislation in the EU. With that, I'd like to go ahead and get started with our presentation. It's important that obviously you join today's presentation because something about the topic interested you, perhaps, and we strongly encourage you to ask questions. And so there's a question and answer tab on the presentation. So if there's some pertinent question that you want to have answered, go ahead and get that in now so that we can make sure that we have sufficient time to make sure you get the most out of today's presentation. I'd like to introduce you to our panelists. My name is Robert Milligan. I'm the co-chair of our National Trade Secrets Non-Compete and Computer Fraud Practice. I'm also joined by my partner Daniel Hart and Justin Beyer. Dan Hart is based in our Atlanta office. He's a partner. He specializes in trade secret non-compete as well as employment litigation. Justin Beyer is a partner in our Chicago office of Seyfarth Shaw. He also specializes in trade secret non-compete and computer fraud legislation. All three of us, not only do we do litigation injunction proceedings, but we also counsel clients, draft agreements, and draft agreements in the employer-employee context as well as in merger and acquisition context. And so this particular piece of legislation is significant to us because it's something that will impact not only our litigation practice, but also our counseling and transactional practice. I'm sure the... I want to get going first with sort of an overview of what we plan to cover in today's presentation. We have it equally divided between the three of us. First off, I'm going to discuss the Defend Trade Secrets Act. I'm going to spend a fair amount describing what the current status of trade secret law is in the United States and provide an overview of the Defend Trade Secrets Act, which is currently pending before Congress. Then my partner Dan Hart will switch to the other side of the Atlantic and spend some time discussing the European Commission's proposed directive on the protection of trade secrets. Finally, my partner Justin Beyer will discuss some practical tips for protecting trade secrets on a global basis in light of these proposed laws and the current state of the legal protections. And then lastly, we'll try to cover any questions that you may have. I'm sure the audience is well aware that trade secret theft is a major concern to businesses globally, but I wanted to share some statistics with you that may be surprising. A few years ago, Create.org and Pricewaterhouse released a white paper that attempted to calculate the economic impact of trade secret theft globally. According to the study, trade secret theft costs anywhere between 1 to 3% of the GDP of the United States and other industrial economies. Similarly, in a study performed a few years ago for the European Commission, the European Commission reported that 1 in 5 businesses, or 20% of businesses included in the study, reported that they had suffered misappropriation or attempted misappropriation of trade secrets in the past 10 years. That number is quite astounding when one considers that the EU includes countries with some of the most advanced economies in the world, and the collective impact of such trade secret theft is easily in the billions of dollars in the EU alone. Now, I don't mean to suggest that we should uncritically accept those statistics. I'm sure that a lot of objections could be raised to both the methodology and the conclusions of these studies, but intuitively, it does seem fairly clear that trade secret theft poses a major risk to both high-tech and low-tech businesses. These concerns are at the heart of the current legislative proposals in the United States and the EU to increase the legal protections afforded to trade secrets. One of the proponents of the trade secret legislation in the United States, part of the backup and support for the proposed bill, he indicated that there's an annual loss of $300 billion to trade secret theft, and that is similar to the annual level of exports to Asian countries, so it can be very significant. Also in support of the legislation, it was quoted that there's a loss of $2.1 million per year as a result of trade secret misappropriation. I now want to get into sort of a current overview of what the law provides as far as protections for trade secrets. Now, the current state of the law in the United States is that trade secrets are typically protected under state law. There is a handful of federal statutes, such as the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, that have some overlap with trade secrets, but in general, there is no federal civil cause of action available to private litigants for trade secret misappropriation. So if your trade secrets are misappropriated, you're typically bringing a cause of action under a state statute, and you're typically, unless you have diversity jurisdiction, you're typically in state court. Now, there is the Economic Espionage Act, and that makes the theft of trade secrets a federal crime in some situations. And the Attorney General can bring civil actions for the violations of the Economic Espionage Act. But as the law currently stands, under the federal requirements, there's no private cause of action for trade secret misappropriation in federal court. It is important to note that the state law, even though at least 47 states have adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act, and North Carolina has adopted a similar version, but there are some distinctions. There are some differences in the adoption of the Uniform Trade Secret Act. Some of the differences relate to the burden on showing whether or not the information is readily ascertainable. Some of the differences include the scope of information that's considered a trade secret. There's also some differences about what different courts have found to be reasonable secrecy measures, which is one of the definitions of a trade secret that you must show. And other states treat the innocent receipt of trade secrets differently. Some characterize that as a violation of the statute. Other states protect innocent acquirers of trade secrets. So there is some difference, it says, under the current regime, even though they have adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act. There's also some differences in statute of limitations. Some states have up to 5 years to bring a trade secret claim. Other states, like California, have a 3-year statute of limitations. And there are still two holdouts that have not adopted the Uniform Trade Secret, that New York and Massachusetts, but they protect trade secrets through state common law tort claims. Now, this lack of uniformity can have practical consequences for employers and others who want to protect their trade secrets. As I indicated, there are some differences, and as there are differences, it can be a challenge for employers to maintain uniform trade secret policies, non-disclosure agreements, as well as uniform practices against the under the backdrop of having 50 different legal regimes. The second consequence is a procedural one. Many litigants often believe that federal court is a better forum for trade secret misappropriation, and as a general rule, it is easier under the federal system to serve third-party subpoenas. In some jurisdictions, it's also easier to obtain emergency and injunctive relief in federal court rather than state court. Now, that can depend, but there are some generalizations that you can say. Since there is no federal civil cause of action for trade secret misappropriation, usually litigants have no basis to be in federal court unless there's diversity jurisdiction or whether there's some other basis for federal jurisdiction, such as the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. For these reasons, over the past several years, many in Congress have attempted to create a civil cause of action for trade secret misappropriation at the federal level, but that has been without success. There was the Amendment to Currency Exchange Rate Oversight Reform Act of 2011. There was also, in 2012, Protecting Trade Secrets and Innovation Act, and Another statute that was proposed was the Private Right of Action Against Theft of Trade Secret Act of 2013, but those all failed and didn't get very much support in Congress. 2014 was the closest that Congress got to passing a federal trade secrets law. That was introduced by Senator Christopher Coons, Democratic senator from Delaware, as well as Senator Orrin Hatch, a Republican senator from Utah. And they introduced the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2014 in the United States Senate. And from a high-level perspective, what it does is it amends the Economic Espionage Act to provide a civil cause of action in federal court to provide litigants a remedy for the misappropriation of a trade secret that is related to a product or service used in or intended for use in interstate or foreign commerce. So you can see there's an interstate commerce hook to the federal basis for jurisdiction. Not to be outdone by the Senate, a few months after the Senate bill was introduced, a bipartisan group of House representatives led by George Holding, a Republican from North Carolina, and Gerald Nadler, a Democrat from New York, introduced a similar bill in the House of Representatives, the Trade Secrets Protection Act of 2014, which largely tracked the Senate bill, but with some tweaks. We're not going to get into those specific tweaks here, but before the House adjourned last year, the House Judiciary Committee did report favorably on the bill and recommend its passage, but it was never brought to the floor of the House for a full vote before the House adjourned last year. Both bills laid the groundwork for two identical bills that are pending right now in both houses of Congress. There have been some changes to the Senate bill that we'll get into, but needless to say, we do have federal trade secret legislation proposed in both the House and the Senate, and there does appear to be bipartisan, bicameral support for the passage of these bills. Now, in 2015, Hatch and Coons introduced the Defend Trade Secrets Act, and that is what this year's bill is based upon, with some provision, with some additions. And House Representative Collins introduced an identical version of the bill in 2015, and that particular bill was approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee. And that the House bill is presently being reviewed by the House Judiciary Committee before it's submitted to the full House. Now, what would these bills do? We want to get into some of the key provisions. Obviously, the bills are somewhat dense, but we do want to explain some of the key provisions of the bills to you, so you can get a handle. As with earlier attempts to pass federal trade secrets law, the Defend Trade Secrets Act is intended to harmonize U.S. law by providing rules and remedies that would apply across all 50 states and all U.S. territory. And they do they propose this by amending the Economic Espionage Act. Now, under the Economic Espionage Act, the misappropriation of trade secrets is already a federal crime, but this would create a civil cause of action. Now, it does use some of the similar terms from the Uniform Trade Secret Act. It adopts the definition of misappropriation from the Uniform Trade Secret Act. It also adopts in whole part the definition of improper means under the Uniform Trade Secret Act. So there is some commonality with respect to using the Uniform Trade Secret Act as a basis for this federal legislation. And you can see one significant thing is that it adopts some key language from the Uniform Trade Secret Act about that information that derives independent economic value, actual or potential, from not being generally known and not readily ascertainable through proper means by the public. It also indicates that improper means does not include reverse engineering or independent derivation, and that can be a key issue, and not all states have adopted that particular version of the Uniform Trade Secret Act, so I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Now, there's been some changes in the House bill compared to the Senate bill. And the first major difference is the House bill has a 5-year statute of limitations, and the Senate bill has a 3-year statute of limitations. And it'll be interesting to see what is reconciled once there's a vote in the Senate and the House as far as reconciling the differences. The bill also includes remedies that go beyond what is currently authorized by the law. For example, in addition to injunctive relief, which is already available in federal court under Rule 65, the bill would authorize courts to issue ex parte orders for the preservation of evidence and seizure in the same way that courts are already authorized to do so in trademark cases. And so what that would mean would be that if you had a trade secret case and you qualified for a ex parte seizure order, that would mean that the defendant in the lawsuit, the first they probably would get notification that you had a lawsuit would be with the federal law enforcement, federal marshal, seizing the alleged misappropriated trade secret. And so that's somewhat of an extraordinary remedy. And the legislation has tried to put in place some safeguards to make sure that particular provision is not abused. Among other remedies provided for in the bills, it authorizes the courts to take affirmative actions to protect trade secrets and authorizes courts to require a misappropriator to pay a royalty for the use of the trade secrets in exceptional circumstances where injunctive relief would be inequitable. The bill also authorizes courts to award exemplary damages in the case of willful or malicious misappropriation. There's some differences between the House and the Senate bill with respect to exemplary damages. In the Senate bill, I believe it's 2 times, and in the House bill, I believe it's 3 times, and so there's going to need to be some reconciliation there as well. There's also some fee shifting, similar to the Uniform Trade Secret Act. If the prevailing parties is able to show that the plaintiff is able to show that the defendant willfully or maliciously misappropriated the trade secret, attorney's fees will be available. And if the plaintiff is unsuccessful and the defendant is able to show that the claim for misappropriation was made in bad faith, then attorney's fees would be made available to the defendant. One piece of dispute about the particular bill would be was with respect to what happens with the doctrine of inevitable disclosure, and under this federal act, could you obtain an injunction that would prevent an employee to go from a direct competitor or from a direct, to leave and go to a direct competitor, particularly if they are a high-level employee and they were going to do the same things. And this particular bill, particularly the Senate version of the bill, makes it clear that inevitable disclosure will not be available under the federal act. And so while you still may be able to obtain an inevitable disclosure injunction in state court, because this federal trade secret bill is not going to preempt the state Uniform Trade Secret Act, under the particular federal statute, you would not be able to obtain an injunction based upon an inevitable disclosure theory. You would be able to obtain an injunction on the basis of actual misappropriation or threatened misappropriation of trade secrets, which is similar to what's available under the which is available under the Uniform Trade Secret Act. One real significant change between the House bill and the Senate bill that I think is very significant, and this somewhat came out of left field, is that the Senate bill recently included a whistleblower provision, and it basically provides an immunity provision to protect individuals from disclosing the trade secret to the government or to their attorney if it's for the purpose of reporting a violation of the law. There was not a lot of discussion regarding this particular provision or the basis or the need for the particular provision. And it puts an affirmative duty on employers to provide notice of this immunity provision in their contracts or in their policies. And the consequence for not putting this particular provision, this immunity provision, in your contracts or policies is that you would not be able to obtain exemplary damages or attorney's fees if you were later to bring a suit against that misappropriator because you did not include the immunity provision. And so there's going to be, from a counseling perspective, if this particular provision is passed, there's going to be a significant amount of work that companies will need to do to make sure that their policies and agreements include this magic immunity provision, magic language, if you want to get the full benefit of the remedies that are be available under the statute. And as we indicated, there's also the ex parte seizure order that's contained in the Senate's version of the Defend Trade Secrets Act. And there was a lot of discussion with respect to ex parte seizure and whether it was necessary. And so I think what the Senate bill tried to do is to try to put additional safeguards so that the provision won't be abused. Other thing that was significant in the Senate's revisions to the Defend Trade Secret Act is that they also increased the criminal penalties for misappropriation of trade secrets. And so you can see that the penalty has gone up significantly for the greater of $5 million or three times the value of the stolen trade secrets. And so that's obviously quite significant. As I mentioned, under the civil statute, the exemplary damages has been lowered in the Senate version of the Senate version of the bill. Now, there's been significant amount of support from the business community with respect to the passage of federal trade secret legislation. It runs as sort of a who's who of corporate America from all different sectors of the economy, from the technology, retail, manufacturing, biotech. And there hasn't been too much opposition apart from some law professors who have come out against the bill, indicating that it's, unnecessary, that the existing legal framework is sufficient to protect trade secrets. And so given the bicameral and bipartisan nature of the bill, it does stand a good chance of being passed. In the House, there's over 125 representatives that have come out in favor of the legislation from both the Republicans and the Democrats. And in the Senate, there's over 50 Senate members who have come out in favor of the bill. And it's simply remarkable in light of how contentious our political systems come this year, you know, with the coming election. And it's remarkable that there has been so much consensus on this bill. So we expect that we expect that there should be a vote in the near future on the particular legislation. And one thing is significant is that a lot of the companies that have come out in favor of the legislation did so before there were these Senate amendments that dealt with the whistleblower protection. And it'll be interesting to see if there's going to be some modifications or tweaks to that, because at this point, the Senate version of the bill is not in accord with the House version of the bill. The House version does not contain the whistleblower protections, and so it'll be interesting if that becomes an area where the House wants to differentiate itself and sort of force the Senate to change that additional proposed language. Certainly from a business perspective, I don't know that the whistleblower protection advances a whole lot, and it probably provides unnecessary language that, you know, could be a quagmire for companies in a going forward basis. And some people have asked, we did get some questions about, well, what's the purpose of this, this ex parte seizure provision? And I think based upon the Senate testimony, it really came out of the DuPont case, where there was a significant trade secret misappropriation case, and there was allegations that the key evidence had been destroyed. And if there had been an ex parte seizure provision to seize and require the preservation of key evidence that not only was evidence of misappropriation, but was also evidence of that should have been preserved, that the case would have advanced much more efficiently in the court system. And so that was one of the reasons they pointed to for the necessity of the ex parte seizure order. With that, I'm sure we're going to have a lot of questions about what the bill means and, you know, what the next steps are. But with that, I'd like to turn it over to my partner, Daniel Hart, who's going to get into what's going over on across the pond in the EU regarding the protection of trade secrets.
Well, thanks, Robert. I think as we talk about what's going on in Europe, we'll see that Europe in a lot of ways is a mirror image of what's going on in the U.S. Trade secret regulation in Europe is perhaps somewhat similar to the situation here in the U.S., except that the lack of uniformity is even more pronounced. And as a little bit of background, in 2013, the European Commission hired the law firm of Baker & McKenzie to conduct a study on trade secrets protections in EU member states by comparison to the protections afforded in the U.S., Switzerland, and Japan. And in their study for the Commission, the authors noted the lack of a uniform legal framework for the protection of trade secrets throughout the EU. Basically, there's no EU-wide legal authority for the protection of trade secrets, and national law in the member states varies dramatically. For example, the study noted that although there are a handful of member states that have statutes on misappropriation, many other countries don't. The member states that have common law systems, such as the UK and Ireland, regulate trade secrets misappropriation by common law causes of action, but those common law claims would not be available in the vast majority of EU member states that don't follow the common law. And substantial differences exist from country to country. Now, the study identified several consequences of this lack of uniformity that, at least according to the author of the study, presented weaknesses for the functioning of the internal market. And the first weakness was that there was no uniform definition of a trade secret within the EU. Second weakness is that actions and remedies available for trade secret theft vary significantly from state to state. And third, there are inadequate measures, at least in the opinion of the study, that are available in many member states to protect trade secrets from disclosure in litigation to enforce trade secrets rights. And so according to the authors of the study, there were some situations in some EU member states where litigants were reluctant to bring a claim for misappropriation of trade secrets because they couldn't be sure that the trade secrets that they were trying to protect would be kept confidential during the litigation. In light of this situation, the European Commission proposed a directive that, if it's adopted by the European Parliament, will require all 28 member states to enact national legislation that meets at least certain minimum standards and provides some minimum remedies. Now, before I go into the details and what the directive would do, let me say a brief word about where the directive is in the process, and I think it would be helpful to get a sense of the timeline here. In 2013, the European Commission originally proposed the directive. In 2014, the Council of the European Union agreed on a general approach for establishing a new legal framework and also proposed some changes to this directive. Then in 2015, various committees of the European Parliament took a look at the proposed directive. First, in March 2015, the Committee on the Internal Market and Consumer Protection took a look and also proposed some amendments. Then the Committee on Industry, Research and Energy issued a report and also proposed some amendments. And then finally, in June of 2015, the Committee on Legal Affairs issued its own report and had a draft resolution that it intended to be presented to the European Parliament. Notably, the Committee on Legal Affairs adopted some of the recommendations that were proposed by the other committees, and they were mostly amendments to address concerns that the directive could have an anti-competitive impact or could be used to chill free expression. Towards the end of last year, in December of 2015, the European Council, as well as representatives of the European Parliament, reached a provisional agreement on the proposed directive, and they agreed on compromise language, which is going to be submitted to the Parliament for approval. This is a fairly Byzantine process of lawmaking in the European Union, but essentially where we are right now is that with the agreement between the Council and representatives of the Parliament, the proposed directive now simply awaits a vote in the European Parliament. Previously, staff of the European Commission in Brussels had reported to us that they expected the Parliament to schedule a first reading around March of 2016, and it was hoped that with the agreement that had already been reached, the directive would be voted and approved on the first reading. That didn't happen. I think originally they scheduled a vote on March 8th. It was pushed off. Currently, the Parliament's in Easter recess. As of this morning, the Parliament website indicates that the directive is tentatively scheduled to be taken up by Parliament on April 13th, which would be during the Parliament's next plenary session. I think it's important to note that with the recent terrorist attacks in Brussels and the ongoing refugee crisis in Europe, it's probably fair to say that trade secrets are probably not at the top of anybody's agenda in the EU. And so it's certainly possible that the date will be moved again in light of other more pressing concerns. But at least right now, tentatively, expect a vote in the Parliament on April 13th. Now, what would the directive do if it's adopted by the European Parliament and the Commission? And for purposes of this discussion, I'm going to refer to the proposed text as it exists in the compromise text after the agreement in December of last year, rather than referring to the Commission's original text. As I mentioned earlier, the directive would require all EU member states to enact national laws to implement the directive. EU directives lay down certain end results that have to be achieved by every member state by a specific date. But the directives don't necessarily tell member states how they have to do that. Individual member states have to adapt their laws to meet the goals, but they're generally free to decide how to do so. In this case, they're also free to adopt more far-reaching protections of trade secrets if they choose to do so, above and beyond what's in the directive, as long as they guarantee some minimum safeguards, such as protections for whistleblowers, which I'll mention in a few more minutes. several features of the directive I think are particularly noteworthy. And the first feature that is worth noting is that the directive provides a common definition of trade secrets, as well as uniform rules about the acquisition, use, and disclosure of trade secrets. And in this regard, you can really see the influence that the Uniform Trade Secrets Act had on the drafters of the directive. You can see the language on the screen provides the definition of trade secrets in the current text of the directive. It's quite similar to the UTSA. It defines trade secrets as information which meets all of the following requirements. One, it's secret in the sense that it is not as a body or in the precise configuration and assembly of its components, generally known among or readily accessible to persons within the circles that normally deal with the kind of information in question. Secondly, it has commercial value because it's a secret. And third, it has been subject to reasonable steps under the circumstances by the person lawfully in control of the information to keep it secret. The directive also has language about when the acquisition of a trade secret is unlawful. And again, you can see the similarity here between the EU directive and the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, as well as the Defend Trade Secrets Act pending in the U.S. Congress. I won't read the language on the slide, but you can see essentially the text of the directive lays out various circumstances in which acquisition of a trade secret is going to be considered unlawful when and if the directive is adopted. And you can also see here some additional language continuing on the definition, which continues on in this slide. I think a second notable feature of the directive is that it requires member states to establish limitations periods for bringing trade secrets misappropriation claims. Currently, with the compromise text, the trade secret is not to exceed 6 years. And this compromise text language on the statute of limitations I think is not coincidental. It should be noted that this is a longer period than that was envisioned either in the European Commission's original proposal or in the Legal Affairs Committee's draft resolution. In the original text, the Commission proposed a limitations period of at least 1 year, but not more than 2 years. The Legal Affairs Committee proposed a statute of limitations of 3 years. Both of which are not uncommon limitations periods. 6 years seems a bit long, maybe to many of us, but it's notable that the current statute of limitations in the UK for a common law claim for breach of confidence or breach of contract is 6 years. Those are typically the common law claims in which litigants in the UK would try to protect trade secrets. And so in this sense, the original directive, had it continued with the proposal for a two-year limitations period, would have actually given less protection to trade secret holders than what's already provided by national law in the UK, which is an EU member state. I think it's probably fair to say that the UK government probably lobbied for the longer limitations period, and that's what we've got now. And so for those of you with operations in the UK, assuming that Britain remains in the EU, which I know is a subject of some minor controversy right now, the proposed directive does not appear to require the UK government to change the existing statute of limitations. Third, really notable feature of the directive is that the directive provides for remedies for civil law redress for trade secrets misappropriation across member states. And among other provisions, it requires member states to provide for injunctive relief, damages, as well as corrective measures to remove infringing goods from the market. Again, member states are free to structure their own national laws the way they desire to do that and achieve those goals, so long as at least these minimum remedies are permitted for trade secret holders. Fourth notable feature of the directive is that it provides some rules on the preservation of trade secrets during litigation. You'll recall, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, that the Baker and McKenzie study in 2013 noted that one of the weaknesses of existing law in some member states of the EU was an apparent reluctance on the part of some litigants to even bring claims to trade secret protection or misappropriation because they weren't satisfied that their trade secrets would be protected appropriately during the litigation process. The directive has some language in there that is meant to address that concern. I should note that the compromise text made some tweaks that might strike some as potentially problematic for businesses with operations in the EU and had some language that was perhaps a weakening of the original text. The original text provided that member states shall ensure that the competent judicial authorities may, on a duly reasoned application by a party, take specific measures necessary to preserve the confidentiality of any trade secret or alleged trade secret used or referred to in the course of the legal proceedings. And among other things, it said that the measures will include the possibility of restricting access to any documents containing trade secrets and to restrict access to hearings when trade secrets may be disclosed and the corresponding records or transcripts. In other words, I think the original text contemplated essentially an attorney's eyes only protective order like those that are typically used in trade secrets cases in the U.S. The compromise text watered down this language somewhat. In the compromise text, and that language now reads, that member states shall ensure measures to protect the trade secrets. And then if you'll see the language here, it said that the member states have to ensure protection of trade secrets during litigation by limiting access to trade secrets to parties, provided that the number of persons referred to in this textual provision shall include at least one natural person from each of the parties and the respective lawyers or other proceedings of those parties, or other representatives of those parties to the proceedings. And so, as written, the current language of the directive would not permit true attorney's eyes only provisions because, by definition, at least one natural person from each party is going to have access to the trade secrets. Having said that, this is probably a vast improvement over existing procedures in some EU member states, which apparently up to this point have not had any kind of protective orders even remotely similar to what's proposed here in the directive. I should mention one other aspect of the directive, and particularly the compromise text, that's very notable and again, similar to what we're seeing with the Defend Trade Secrets Act in Washington. Literally at the last minute during the negotiations in December, the representatives of the European Parliament added language to the directive to protect whistleblowers in many ways very similar to the language that the Senate added to the Defend Trade Secrets Act. And under the current language of the directive that will be going to Parliament for a vote, there will be a defense required by the directive and all member states' national law for using trade secrets and misappropriating trade secrets if one is acting as a whistleblower. The specific language says that this defense would apply whenever a trade secret was acquired, used, or disclosed for revealing a misconduct, wrongdoing, or illegal activity, provided that the respondent acted for the purpose of protecting the general public interest. So again, it's very clear that there's great similarities between what's going on in Washington right now and what's going on in Brussels with respect to these legislative proposals. So what's next? As I previously noted, the directive is awaiting a first reading in the European Parliament. That's currently scheduled for April 11th, and it's expected to be approved on a first reading. As currently drafted, if the directive is adopted, member states would have to ensure that their national law conforms to the directive within 24 months of its adoption. I should note that there is some open question at this point as to whether common law countries will need to enact statutes that implement these provisions, despite the fact that common law already provides remedies consistent with the directive. In the UK, for example, back in 2014, the House of Commons European Scrutiny Select Committee reviewed the proposed directive. The government at the time, which was the coalition government, not the majority conservative government now, noted that the protection of trade secrets under UK common law is consistent with the directive. However, the government said it's unclear if the UK Parliament is going to have to pass implementing legislation or if the UK can continue to rely on common law remedies, again, assuming that the UK votes to stay in the EU, which is up in the air at the moment. So that's an open question that certainly will impact businesses in the UK, as well as in potentially other common law jurisdictions within the EU. Now, before I move on, I think it's important to note that the proposed EU directive, if it's enacted, will only be helpful to trade secret holders if they take the necessary steps to protect their trade secrets so that they can rely on the directive. And the same thing certainly is true with respect to the Defend Trade Secrets Act. And so now I'll hand it over to my partner Justin to talk about some practical steps that companies should take in light of all these developments.
Thanks, Dan. And before we move on, we'd like to now provide you with the code for CLE credit. To receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you by the end of this week. The code is SS4282. Again, the code is SS4282. And we're going to now move on to talk about some of the, and I apologize, that's S as in Sam, 4282. I'd like to now focus on some practical tips that we generally recommend to all of our clients who are instituting or maintaining a trade secret, confidentiality, restrictive covenant policy. These will be mainly focused on employers in the United States, but there is some universal applicability regardless of whether you're a U.S.-based company or a company that has employees abroad. First and foremost, with any confidentiality policy or non-compete program, it needs to be a very much a process-oriented approach. And what I mean by that is we highly recommend having company-wide policies in place that are going to be effectuated at various times during an employee's employment with the company. The onboarding process, policies related to reminders of confidentiality obligations or updating policies throughout an employee's employment with a company, updates to policies if there is a promotion for an employee, and certainly various policies that are in place when an employee leaves the company. Really, diligence is the name of the game when you're protecting or prosecuting claims for misappropriation of trade secrets or violations of a restrictive covenant. And what we mean by that is courts view very favorably when employers come in with obvious evidence of misappropriation of trade secrets or violations of restrictive covenants as early as practical. And while Dan and Robert both spoke about the various various statutes of limitations for acts that may take, may be enacted either in the United States or the EU, the reality is that if you wait toward the end of a statute of limitations, courts generally view claims less favorably than they do with claims that are brought sooner rather than later. Effectively, courts don't want to see employers sit on their claims and allow these type of actions to take place. So it's really important for employers to, to not only review their policies and be aware of changes in the law, but also to ensure that whoever is charged with enforcing those policies, and generally that's going to be your HR department or possibly in-house legal department, are sufficiently trained on both the new laws, but also on the enforcement of the policies, the implementation of those policies during the course of an employee's employment. So we're going to cover a variety of things very quickly, seeing as how the most interesting part of this presentation were Robert and Dan's pieces, but reviews and updating template restricted covenant agreements, reviewing and revising onboarding procedures, reviewing policies related to your IT resources, generally speaking, bring your own devices to work, review of security procedures for sensitive documents, and a review of the exit interview termination process. The one piece that I'd like to focus on, and there I understand there's a variety of things that are here, is it's very important that companies have a consistent policy for when new employees are going to sign these agreements. We've seen a lot of movement in the last several years in various states around the United States that have changed the question of what is valid consideration. Whereas it used to be that an employee can sign a non-compete agreement effectively at any point during their employment, and the continued employment was sufficient consideration. We've seen a number of states move away from that, either viewing continued employment as not being sufficient consideration or requiring the employee to be employed for a certain amount of time beyond signing the non-compete if continued employment is the sole source of the consideration. And so the best practice for any employer is going to be to have their employees sign it prior to them being onboarded at the company. Now, that could be in certain states like New Hampshire or Oregon, for example, require that the employee sign the agreement a certain number of days before starting the employment to either signing it at the outset of employment. But there is case law out there that specifically says that if they start, and even if they sign a few days after, that's not deemed to be at the outset of employment. So that's important. The other piece of this is, and this is to tie this back to the portion that Robert was talking about the bill that's being considered by the Senate and the House right now, one of the key portions that I hear from the standpoint of creating policies is this indemnity language that needs to be inserted in the policy, or at least there needs to be a reference to it. Now, a lot of the companies we work with will typically incorporate their confidentiality provisions into the employment agreement that also contains your non-compete, your non-solicit of customers, your non-solicit of employees. If the Senate version of this bill goes through, in order to be able to obtain attorney's fees and the treble damages, the double damages under the Senate version, you would need to have this language referencing the indemnity provision contained in the agreement, which is difficult because when you consider back to the consideration piece, if you have a confidentiality provision contained where the restrictive covenants are, you would effectively need to potentially enter into a new restrictive covenant with the employee, which may require certain costs to the employee into the employer, be it a bonus, be it a promotion. There's obviously the cost, the internal cost of implementing a new policy. So that's a piece that bears viewing, because the way the Senate bill reads, potentially you'd be out a very valuable piece of damages if that isn't included in there. The other piece is that when it comes to onboarding, you really want to make sure that the employee is disclaiming any possession of their former employer's trade secrets or confidential information. We generally recommend to our clients that they include something in the offer letter that that they're not only certifying that they don't have it, but they also certify they won't use it, and they understand that is grounds for punishment up to and including termination. That's really very much a CYA to every employer. And then the other thing is that if you're utilizing social media policies, you want to make sure that those social media policies are consistent with the directives given by the NLRB. There's been a series of high-profile decisions by the NLRB within the last several years which may invalidate the social media policy and may, in fact, subject the company to possible damages or civil penalties for failure to abide by it. The next place we want to talk about briefly is the use of IT resources. Specifically, if you are going to require or permit a bring your own device, it's very important to have a policy related to that. What devices are appropriate, what devices are not. You have to provide clear directive on who actually owns the information on the device. There needs to be pieces in there also discussing when the company gets access to the device and the data. There should be software incorporated that allows incident remote wiping procedures, specifically if you're going to have company email on there. There's a few little known ways that misappropriation can occur on devices, such as effectively opening email in one email account and then changing the sender to your separate email account, so your personal email account, and it doesn't show up as a sent email in your company email, which is kind of scary when you think about it, because you wouldn't even have knowledge that they had transferred the information later on. So that's another thing to take into consideration when even permitting a bring your own device policy or allowing private email accounts to be on there. Next, and this is another piece of this sort of this same puzzle, the during employment piece, is you want to have policies in place for use of sensitive documents. Some of this can be incorporated through an IT use policy, but there are also other things to take into consideration of what software and what programs you're utilizing on your company hardware and software. Is the data encrypted? Is there a policy or are there programs in place that restrict access on a need-to-know basis? Are hard copies of documents locked in closets or drawers? Are documents password protected? Does your company have a policy that either tracks printing or restricts printing of certain documents? And are there policies in place or procedures in place to limit access to sensitive documents remotely? All of these questions are ones that you should be taking into consideration in attempting to protect your information. These are all things that the courts are going to take a look at when they consider whether or not you have taken sufficient steps to protect the trade secret information. And the last area we want to talk about quickly is the exit interview / termination process. You want to be very diligent in this process for a couple reasons. One is to attempt to minimize the ability of an employee to take sensitive information with them upon exiting employment. Second is if you are going to eventually prosecute a case for violations of a non-compete agreement or a non-solicit, utilizing the exit interview / termination process is a good way to start to acquire some of this information. So it's the best practice to have sort of a template worksheet that your HR or your management personnel are going to utilize to ask questions such as, have they turned over all their property? Have they turned over external media devices? Are they going to work for a competitor? Are they going to work in the same territory? Are they going to work in a substantially similar job position? Are they going to be calling on clients? Are they going to be calling on their same clients? So these are some of the questions that you want to utilize here. You also assume, and this depends on a company-by-company basis, but generally speaking, if you're in a situation where your employee is giving a 2 weeks notice, but they've notified you that they're going to a competitor, you have to ask the question, do we want to take the 2 weeks or do we want to disable their access to company computer networks immediately? And what are you doing if these individuals are maintaining social media accounts to obtain usernames and passwords, things along those lines? And then finally, you want to also take into consideration what you do after these employees actually leave the company. You want to make sure that your HR personnel are have in their possession any agreements that these individuals have signed. You want to remind them of their continuing obligations. You may want to consider a letter to the new employer to remind them of their obligations. And you also want to take into consideration what you do to preserve information. A lot of companies these days have automatic deletion policies, which after 30 days, emails are automatically deleted. The problem with that is that sometimes it takes beyond 30 days to know that these individuals have either misappropriated trade secrets or have are now soliciting customers on their new employer's behalf. So you may want to consider putting in a longer stay on those emails. These days, putting in a new hard drive is fairly inexpensive. You may want to consider a policy of changing out the hard drive and maintaining that for some period of time. So that really wraps up our practical tips. We do have one question that I do see, seeing as we're over time. If you're interested in staying on to hear the answer, I'm going to turn it over to Robert, who I think is probably best equipped to answer that particular question. But otherwise, thank you for joining us today. We've had a great time giving you some information about this. You can find out more about about anything going on in the trade secret and non-compete world by visiting our blog, tradesecretslaw.com, and you can reach any of us at our below contact information. And Robert, if you'd like to answer the question.
Sure. Thanks, Justin. The question revolves around the whistleblower protection in the proposed Defend Trade Secrets Act, and some clarification with respect to what exactly does the statute, you know, protect. And what the proposed legislation says is that an individual shall not be held criminally or civilly liable under federal or state trade secret law that for any disclosure that is made to the federal, state, or local government or to an attorney solely for the purpose of reporting or investigating a suspected violation of law, or made in a complaint or other document filed in a lawsuit or proceeding if such filing is made under seal. And I think, you know, this particular provision is incredibly problematic, and I think that, you know, Dan and Justin would agree. You know, this particular provision has its is susceptible to tremendous amount of abuse. A trade secret misappropriator could quickly turn their case into a, quote, whistleblower type case. They can also, under this immunity provision, have the right to share the trade secret with their attorney, you know, government officials, even if it's just a suspected violation of the law. Even worse is that they can file it in the court of law. So if it's your trade secret, if it's your source code, if it's your customer list, they can file it in a public proceeding. There's filing supposed to be under seal, but I can tell you that, having done lots of these cases, that parties appropriately filing documents under seal, particularly in e-filing or paper filings, it doesn't always go as planned, and to give the quote whistleblower immunity to file the trade secrets in the public realm, I don't even think the courts really want to see the documents most of the time, but to give them immunity for doing so is, you know, highly problematic. We got another question also has to do with some clarification regarding what happens to the Uniform Trade Secret Act, and is the state law, does it go away? Is this federal law going to preempt the state law? And the answer to that is no, it doesn't. And so it's an unusual scenario where you could be in federal court, you could be suing for a violation of the federal trade secret statute, you could also be suing for a violation of the state trade secret statute. The other interesting wrinkle is that it's not exclusive jurisdiction. So you could also bring these federal claims in state court. Now, the other side would have the ability to remove it to federal court, much like you can do in the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. You would also have the capability to bring these federal claims in state court. So, interesting stuff. If you do have any follow-up questions, feel feel free to reach out to the panel. And again, we'll be following up with a copy of the today's materials. And our next trade secret webinar, I believe, is on April 14th, and it's about protecting trade secrets in the financial services industry. So feel free to go onto our website and register for that particular webinar. Have a great day, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, and this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.